Good afternoon. It's 4 o'clock on Thursday, November 15th, 2018. This is an informal hearing on Meadowlark Wind 1 LLC's application for a certificate of site compatibility for the New Frontier Wind Energy Project in McHenry County. I'm Randy Christman, Chairman of the Commission, joined by Commissioners Brian Krasius and Julie Fedorchak. And we will identify everyone at the table, but before we do that, I just want to emphasize this is an informal hearing, so it involves only undisputed facts. If there are disputed facts which arise, we will have to wrap up and issue a notice of hearing and go to a full hearing. The applicant will go first when we get started, but first, if we can just go around the table and have everyone identify themselves on the record.
John Shute, the Public Service Commission.
Patrick Font, the Public Service Commission.
John Sohn with Capital Power.
Paul Wendelgass with Capital Power.
Molly Smith with Frederickson and Byron.
Jerry Lynn with PSC.
Okay. Commissioner Krasius, did you have any opening comment or anything?
I do not.
Commissioner Fedorchak?
No.
Okay. Molly, we'll turn it over to you or one of the gentlemen.
So I will let Paul and John introduce themselves a little bit more thoroughly in a second, and then I have a set of exhibits that I've given to everyone at the table. Also, Jack had suggested that I provide a proposed amended order with the language identified that we would propose amending, so that document is also before you. So I'll let these gentlemen introduce themselves more thoroughly. I then will give you a bit of the history of this project. It's had quite a long history, and I think Jerry and I realized we may be the only ones that were involved other than Alana from the beginning. So I want to give the background before we start and why we're here, and then we'll walk through those exhibits. So, Paul, do you want to start?
Sure. I'm Paul Wendelgass. I lead the Capital Power Renewable Development Team in the U.S., based out of Boston, and we our team of about half a dozen people developing mainly wind power projects. We do some work on solar for Capital Power in its U.S. operations.
And John?
Can you spell your last name, Paul?
It's Wendelgass.
I guessed right.
That was an S short. John?
Well, good afternoon, everyone. My name is John Sohn. I'm the U.S. Director for Government Relations at Capital Power. And in that role, I'm responsible for our engagement on policy and regulatory matters with government officials and regulators across the U.S., where we have natural gas, wind, solar, biomass assets that we're either developing or managing. One of our key corporate principles is around self-disclosure and transparency. So when the issues of this project came up, it was in our corporate culture to bring them forth and try to find positive resolutions, and that's why we're here today. And I also want to thank you all for your time and for putting this on your schedule so quickly. I know you have busy schedules, so we appreciate that. Thank you.
Could you two spell your last name, John?
Sure, it's S-O-H-N.
And John is J-O-N.
Got it.
Jonathan.
Jonathan. So as far as the history of this project, the project originally applied for a certificate of site compatibility back in 2011, and that certificate of site compatibility order and certificate were issued in April of 2012. And at that time, Meadowlark was owned by a company called Element Power. And so they were assisting Meadowlark with the development. At the time the order was issued, the certificate were issued, there were no turbine-specific exclusion areas in the rules. Siting setbacks were unwritten, and they were typically included through the applicant's commitments in the orders. So, for instance, in this particular order that was issued in 2012, there were findings of fact that outlined the setbacks that were to apply to the project. And those commitments then were to be binding per the order. In 2012, 2013, there was a commission rulemaking process. As part of the rulemaking, the turbine-specific exclusion areas were proposed, and those rules were ultimately published in April of 2013. So that was about a year after Meadowlark obtained its certificate. In December of 2014, Capital Power acquired Meadowlark as well as some other assets from Element Power. And then, because the project was not, they didn't initiate construction within 4 years of the issuance of the certificate, there was an application for continuing suitability, certification, I should say, of continuing suitability that was filed in November of 2016. And under North Dakota Century Code Section 49.22.17, Meadowlark was required to certify to the commission that the site continued to meet the conditions upon which the certificate was issued, and also to request an order authorizing construction and specifying the date by which construction had to begin. Because at the time, Meadowlark also was aware of the 2013 rulemaking and understood those setbacks and believed that the project complied with those setbacks, voluntarily committed to complying with the 2013 setbacks as well as what was in the original order. So the commission issued an order of continuing suitability in May of 2017. That order memorialized Meadowlark's commitment to comply with the 2013 wind-specific setbacks in an order provision. It also memorialized a commitment to setback turbines 1,400 feet from occupied residences. Then in late summer of this year, early fall of this year, Meadowlark commissioned an ALTA survey to be conducted by West Wind Engineering. ALTA surveys are often done as part of financing and to ensure all setbacks are complied with, so that's one of the things that they're looking at. Through that process, it was discovered that for turbine 26 and turbine 32, when Tetra Tech, who did the original certificate of continuing suitability filing, when they did the measurements for those turbines, they measured the setback from the center line of State Highway 41 instead of the edge of the right-of-way, and Westwood identified that during their survey. They also identified that turbine 6 was also measured from the center line of the Great River Energy Transmission Line right-of-way, and they identified two residences that were less than 1,400 feet from occupied turbines that were less than 1,400 feet from occupied residences. So after this was discovered, turbine 32 was approximately 104 feet, I believe, inside the 1.1 times turbine tip height setback. That turbine was voluntarily just moved without discussion by Meadowlark. They submitted the appropriate modification of the layout, the documentation recently, and that turbine is actually, the turbine foundation has just been poured. So that one is being moved already.
Outside, so why was that one caught before construction and these others?
It wasn't. They're just moving it.
The foundation was laid?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So there isn't the process of checking the measurements before you do the construction?
I would defer to Paul, but I would say from talking to them, this is not a common issue that has arisen in any other project. And I know, given that this project was acquired from Element Power, there were some discrepancies in what form of GIS or the type of system that they were using to measure the pinpoints of the turbine locations. I don't know if that much about that piece of it, but I would say this isn't common, and Paul please.
No, this is the only we've built. This is the sixth wind plant we're building since 2012. This is the only time we've encountered this kind of a problem, and we've built in other jurisdictions like the province of Ontario in Canada, where you have similar kinds of stringent setback limits.
And there, it's a subcontractor that did the measurements.
Tetra Tech did the application for the certificate of continuing suitability for us. And in that application, they prepared a table of measurements showing how far each of the turbines were going to be moved. All of the turbines that are the subject of our discussion today were listed in that table with very specific distances being moved. None of our team ever checked to confirm where they were setting them back from. We accepted Tetra Tech's advice, given their experience as a company in developing applications and permitting wind projects in North Dakota. And frankly, we were kind of surprised when we learned that their team had erroneously applied the setbacks from the center line of the road right-of-way rather than from the edge of right-of-way, for example.
And tell me again how that was discovered.
So they were doing Westwood. Westwood was doing an ALTA survey, and an ALTA survey does do a very specific calculation for each turbine location. It's usually done as part of financing, so you guys are going through tax equity financing, and it's required for that type of financing to demonstrate compliance with the setbacks. And you typically also do a permitting opinion to say that the permits are up to date and in force and applicable. So there's a very stringent review of all the setback requirements as part of that survey process, and that's when it was caught.
Okay.
So you're saying this all goes back to Tetra Tech?
It goes back at least to the I can say from my part, I certainly wasn't aware it was expressed in the certification of continuing suitability that, as proposed, the layout complied with the setbacks, including the 2013 setbacks that were subsequently applied to the project. So as far as those that were involved knew, everyone believed that the setbacks were being complied with. It wasn't until the ALTA survey identified something different.
And how much work does Tetra Tech do in North Dakota?
A lot. A lot of projects in North Dakota.
So they understand the law perfectly well.
I can't speak for Tetra Tech. I can say that I've been involved and I understand the law, and when I advise about the law, I understand how to apply that particular setback, and that particular one is clear from the road right-of-way. After the issues were identified, and the one turbine we've already discussed.
Well,
yeah, go ahead.
Is Highway 41 the one that runs north, like from Russo to Velva? And
yes.
Or from Velva to...
Runs north-south, and it's the only state highway in the project area.
Okay.
So this issue is raised...
What is their right-of-way?
They have a 100-foot right-of-way on either side of the center line.
100 feet?
Yes, okay. So 200 feet total. Okay. After the issue is raised, we spoke with Jerry and with Jack to discuss... any potential next steps for addressing the issues with the turbine setbacks. With respect to our request today, we're specifically requesting that there be an amendment of the order of continuing suitability. And in part, that's because if you look, and I have the draft here that may be the easiest way to take a look at it, but if you look at order paragraph 4B, so order paragraph 4B is the one that said that Meadowlark would comply with the siting criteria that were set forth in section 6906.0801 as of the date of this order of continuing suitability. And so because that is a commitment that was made by the project, it wasn't part of what those rules were not in place when the order was initially granted. This is a commitment made by the project that could be modified to allow the turbine setbacks to be changed for the two particular turbines that are at issue. And I want to break that down a little bit because we've got a difference here between those two particular turbines. So while with respect to turbine 26, there is a clear way in which the setback should be measured from the road right-of-way, for the setback from transmission facilities, it's silent as to where that's supposed to be measured from. So it doesn't say center line, it doesn't say edge of road right-of-way. So technically, I don't believe that it was an error to measure it from the center line, because it simply is not specified where to measure it. And so if our position would be that we think that that was a reasonable interpretation, since there are other setbacks that are measured from the center line as opposed to the edge of right-of-way. In the alternative, even if that isn't the commission's position, you know, for all projects, in this particular case, it is unclear, and we would seek leniency on this particular matter because, one, that rule wasn't in place when the initial order was issued, and two, there was a lack of clarity as far as how that should be measured. With respect to the two turbines that are within the 1,400 feet of a residence, that is clearly a voluntary commitment because there is no state requirement at that time. There certainly wasn't for setbacks from residences. And it's common to see waivers of a 1,400-foot setback. The county's setback requirement is 500 feet for participating and 1,300 feet for non-participating. So this is still... these are 1365 and 1395, 5 feet and 35 feet.
And these are both participating.
One is a participating residence. The other is not, but their family participates, and they have both signed waivers of the setback commitment.
Help me out a little bit here.
Sure.
So we're talking about what's the acreage footprint? Of this?
Oh, good question.
Overall, I think we
just ballpark.
We have agreements over about 10,000 acres, Commissioner.
Okay, so 10,000 acres, and when you've got that much landmass to deal with, what's the reasoning behind crowding the setbacks so much?
So I know that So this project originally proposed 49 turbine locations, and they're not constructing 49 turbine locations at this point, or they originally proposed more than they're currently constructing. There was a commitment to landowners to try to ensure to the extent possible that each landowner got a turbine. It was a very important consideration of the landowners when this was purchased by Capital Power. So I know that went into the siting. And it's not uncommon that they're close to, that turbines would be close to setbacks. It was simply an error in the measurement of the one.
In both cases, Commissioner, the setback on the mapping that we had and that we provided as part of our application for certificate of continuing suitability so showed setbacks in excess of 1,400 feet, I think, in the one case. 1,423 feet, in the other case about 1,430. And we expected those to be accurate.
So let me ask you this. In various cases we've had when sometimes maybe someone objected to a position on a wind farm, we heard from engineers that, you know, this is very fussy and, you know, it's not as simple as just moving it 50 feet or something like that because the best energy production is going to be at a certain spot. So with the work that was done by whoever here, are many of these in the wrong places? Or is it just these that happen to be in the wrong places and are in exclusion areas? Or is this whole thing a problem that you don't have them where they ought to be?
These are the only turbines that are not where they're supposed to be.
And all of them happened, all the ones that are misplaced happen to have been misplaced by an exclusion area?
I believe that's, I just defer to Molly on whether there are.
Well, I think, the reason this was identified is because the ALTA survey looks at setbacks. And so the setbacks were given to Westwood. And when they applied them, they identified that these did not comply with those setback commitments. That's.
They didn't really look to see whether they're in the optimal location for energy production necessarily.
No, they would have been looking for compliance with setback requirements, yes. And so because this was a commitment, because we do have waivers, we are requesting both the amendment of 4B and the amendment of 4C, and we'll walk through some exhibits here in a minute. But as we explained in the request, granting these particular amendments will not impact public health or safety. This has been, this is a position that is in alignment with what GRE has found and what the DOT has found, and we'll talk a little bit more as we walk through the exhibits. And it will avoid additional environmental and landowner impacts. We'll also talk about that as we walk through the exhibits. It, of course, would increase the cost to move the turbines, and it would potentially impact the project schedule. This is a very unique situation. I don't know of any other project. One, there's no other project that's gone through a continuing suitability process. This is the first and only project. And this won't be setting a precedent for other projects for that reason, because this isn't something where we're asking for a change of an exclusion area. We're asking for a modification of a commitment made that was a commitment to comply with exclusion areas and put in place after the initial order was issued. So it's a very different, unique situation. So we'll, unless you want to, I sense you have a question, Commissioner. Go ahead.
Well, it doesn't really apply to this case, but just to clear it up, we did do another project with a continuing certificate. So this is not
since
the only
one.
Since this one? I don't remember which order they were, but we've done
this one was the first one I know. I'm not aware of another. I wasn't aware of another one, so thank you for clarifying. Let's walk through the exhibits. And Paul's going to explain what you're seeing. So if you take the packet, and we've kind of grouped these exhibits by turbine to hopefully make it a little bit easier to follow. But Paul, can you identify what we've got here marked as Exhibit 1?
Certainly. Exhibit 1 shows in the lower right corner, Turbine 24, which is on the east side of Highway 41. And in the upper left side of that same exhibit, you see a solid black line which shows the setback for occupied residential dwellings of 1,400 feet. And that encroaches on that house owned by Joseph and Penny Seville by 5 feet. And
remind us where is this particular turbine at as far as construction?
This turbine is complete. It was installed. Its foundation was installed, and the turbine was erected. The collector line and access roads were installed to it, and it's connected. I'm not aware as to whether it has yet been commissioned.
But it's essentially ready to go.
It's essentially ready to go, except for perhaps completion of commissioning at this point.
Okay. And then if we look at Exhibit 2, can you? Sure, Jack.
You said this was T24 on the upper left-hand corner?
Yes. No, yeah, this is T24, Turbine 24, which has a setback intrusion on the residents across Highway 41 from it to the northwest.
Is Highway 24...
Highway 41.
Is Highway 41 on this
T24? No, it's not on the T24. It's on the right-hand picture to the right of it.
Okay.
To the left-hand side of the exhibit.
Yes.
That is Highway 41, and the residence is on the west side of Highway 41. The turbine is on the east side of Highway 41. Turbine 24 meets all the other setback requirements. It's strictly 5 feet too far, too close to the residents.
I guess what I'm a little bit confused is I'm not sure where that's on this map.
Right. Me too.
It's the surveyor actually cut out the intervening land because to show a 1,400-foot setback would have required either a lot more paper.
He was trying to show it to scale.
A much smaller scale.
That makes sense. I apologize. That makes sense.
Where's the road on this line?
Yeah, the road is actually off.
It's
on the right-hand side of the left image. But
this is this?
No, that's not.
So pretend there's a gap. So this is a picture here. This is a picture here. But they didn't. It would be a picture 3 pages long if we showed at this scale, and they were trying to show this scale. So you just pretend that there's land in between these two squares. So there's a turbine here, and there's a house over here with Highway 41 between them.
Okay. So this is right here. Is this?
No. They're two. They're
what's
independent.
The point of this?
Totally independent of each other. So this is the house that has the setback. This is the 1,400 feet from the turbine. This is the turbine just over here.
Okay.
So these are two independent pictures. They're
okay.
They're to the same scale, but
the circles
are
what throws me off on the
essentially,
right. One.
Essentially, it's. On some drawings, you often see a squiggly line that shows that we've omitted some element of the drawing in between, and that's essentially what the surveyor did here, omitted a chunk of the drawing in between in order to not just show us a large expanse of empty field.
Right. So just on the bottom right picture, the circle is actually just the rotor diameter.
The circle on the red dashed circle on the bottom right picture is the rotor diameter, yes.
Okay.
Sorry.
I did warn him these might be tough to It was good scale, so we wanted to show it.
So since you're showing that with the rotor diameter and that, what is this that's so close to the rotor diameter? Or is that what's underneath that rotor diameter we shouldn't even pay any attention to?
Commissioner, I'm not sure what that is in that
looks
field.
Looks like a house.
I don't believe it's not a residence.
Oh. Okay.
It's not a residence, I'm sure of that.
All right.
He doesn't have his rock spread yet.
I'm still assuming we're way higher than we are. All right.
So if you look at Exhibit 2, can you tell the commissioners what that is?
Exhibit 2 is a setback waiver agreement signed by the owners of the residence, shown on Exhibit 1, Joseph and Penny Seville, waiving the setback constraints under the state regulation.
So they're T-24?
Actually, they have two other turbines on lands that they own. T-24 is actually on land owned by another participating family.
So they are a participant, but they don't have T-24. So let's look at Exhibit 3. And this is Turbine 8. Can you explain what's shown in this?
Sure. Exhibit 3 shows you Turbine 8, and again, we've omitted much of the intervening imagery, much as was done with Exhibit 1. The turbine is to scale, and the red dashed line shows the rotor diameter. It's on property owned by Curtis and Diana Nelson. In the lower right side of that same exhibit, you see a black line, which is the 1,400-foot setback from that turbine's center. It encroaches on a house owned by Eric Nelson, Curtis and Diana's son. They carved out an outlot from their property, which surrounds this land, and he and his wife reside in this residence. And we have... In this case, you can see that the black line passes about 35 feet through the garage section of the house and between 8 and 16 feet through the balance of the house.
And
the actual residential parts of the house.
Just to clarify, so there was a lease on this property before this outlet was created. So technically the whole property is subject to the lease, and then the outlet was created for this particular house. But... just to make that a little bit clear. So and you could view them as
outlot.
Outlot, sorry. Outlot, not outlet.
These small subdivided lots are described as outlots, according
to... So you're saying that house wasn't there just a few years ago?
It wasn't there when the lease for the wind project was initially granted.
But when the site was permitted, it was.
When we applied for the certificate of continuing suitability, it was. I can't speak to prior to that, Commissioner.
Either, for sure. And then if you look at Exhibit 4, can you tell the commissioners what Exhibit 4 is?
Exhibit 4 is a waiver signed by Eric and Amy Nelson, the owners of the residence depicted in Exhibit 3, again waiving the land use restrictions and the 1,400-foot setback under the state regulations from TA.
Yes. And this turbine is also up and
complete.
Okay.
It's prepared to run.
And if we look at Exhibit 5, so this is a little bit different scale, so we'll walk through this one differently, but can you explain what this one shows?
Exhibit 5 shows turbine number 6, which is on the west side of the project. Turbine number 6 is located on land owned by Luella Anderson. And the black line shows the 1.1 times blade tip height setback from the turbine. So it shows a 541-foot radius from the center of the turbine, which is 1.1 times our 492-foot height blade tip. And as you can see, that falls between the westernmost conductor of the Great River Energy transmission line and the center conductor of that same transmission line.
And if you look at Exhibit 6, can you explain what that is?
Exhibit 6 is a letter from the owner of that property, Luella Anderson, expressing her desire that the turbine remain where it is to avoid any additional impacts to her property.
And just to be clear, we did draft this on her behalf to send to her. She had indicated she would sign a letter, and so we drafted it up for her, she did sign it.
Did she or the previous landowner receive any additional compensation?
None of these are receiving any additional compensation beyond what's agreed to in their leases, no, Commissioner.
Right. And then exhibits.
Distance? Is that about, it looks like maybe 70 feet that it's... Too close from the right-of-way line?
No, it is from the westernmost conductor, it is, it is 15.8 feet too close to the westernmost conductor.
How many feet?
15.8 feet too close to the westernmost conductor. One of the problems, Commissioner, as Molly has pointed out, is it's unclear what the setback is to be from the cable, the center line, or the edge of right-of-way. And our surveyor measured it off the cable, the nearest cable.
So if it's from the center line, it would actually comply because it's on the western side of the center line. If it's from the edge of the right-of-way, which is the black dotted line, then it would be within. And is that the 15 feet you're referencing?
What is it from? 15. The 15 feet is from the leftmost of the three white dashed lines, which show the three conductors.
How wide is the right-of-way?
The right-of-way is 75 feet from either side of the center line.
So it's
I think, Commissioner, you're probably correct. It's roughly 70 feet from the western edge of the right-of-way to where the setback falls within the right-of-way.
Somewhere in the filing, I read that it was 34 feet.
So I think that is if.
That's if this happened.
If the
turbine fell like that.
Straight over, it would still be
34
feet
away from the transmission line.
Okay.
And while we're on this, I would say from my perspective, I have never taken viewed this as specifying from the edge of the right of way in the rule itself, because it references the facility. I don't know how that could be interpreted as the edge of the right of way. So I would agree with where I think you were going with this, which is at most it would be 15 feet over the edge of the facility and not the center line. So it's much less than the 70 feet because there's no reference to right of way within the rule.
So again, going back to Tetra Tech, how would they interpret that the measurement should be from the center line?
I don't know.
Based on how?
I don't know how they came to their measurement. We just know that that was the result. I don't know how they came to the center line. I don't recall having any discussions.
I think based on that logic that they could argue that it's the furthermost edge of the right-of-way to take the measurement from.
Are you saying that, in this case, the easternmost?
Sure. Who's to say that they couldn't?
I mean, I suppose they could.
Take that approach.
I think...
Not logically, but just take that approach.
I think the issue is that it's not specified. So some setbacks are specified as the center line. Some are specified as the edge of the right-of-way. This one says nothing.
So it's from right of way, correct?
The writing of the...
Yeah, I have it. So it says 1 1/10 times the height of the turbine from a 115 kilovolt or higher transmission line. And that's all it says.
Okay.
From the right of way.
No. It just says... I'll read it again. 1 1/10 times the height of the turbine from a 115 kilovolt or higher transmission line. And that's it.
Well, regardless whether it's right away or not, this falls within the westernmost conductor of it, so it's not 1.1 times the height from the power line.
I think the problem is that you have others that are measured from the center line. So when you do road right-of-way for township and county, you measure from the road right-of-way plus they specify 75 feet. So you've got center line plus 75 feet. This doesn't say, so you could say center line, and then it just doesn't specify from where else.
I understand that, but that's one argument,
mm-hmm.
whether... because it doesn't specify.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the argument of well, you know, it doesn't specify the right-of-way line,
mm-hmm.
that really doesn't matter because this does get within 1.1 times the height from the line itself.
I think
so the right-of-way really isn't the issue here.
Commissioner, we're not disputing that. That's
right.
Why we have it in front of you.
Yeah, and that's why we're seeking. I don't think that. I think the problem is that there is ambiguity. It's not specified. But even setting that aside, with the amendment that we're seeking, that addresses the issue. And if the commission's position is it needs to be from the edge of the, you know, conductor, that, you know, that's. You've clarified. You've made your interpretation, and that's what everyone would understand going forward as well.
Is GRE the transmission?
Yes.
Avenue for this generation.
We interconnect to GRE's substation in Velva. It's their McHenry substation. We built a separate 115 kV line up the east side of the property project. It interconnects to GRE's 115 kV substation in Velva, where this transmission line also connects. We didn't connect to this line here. But
so GRE is the transmission avenue for the power, but not this particular line?
That's correct.
Is that what you're saying?
Okay. That's correct.
And can you explain what Exhibit 7 is?
Yes. Exhibit 7
is... Did we talk about 6 already?
Yeah.
Exhibit 6 is...
Oh, okay, yep, that's the landowner.
The landowner.
Okay.
Exhibit 7 is an email exchange between me and Crystal DeBrun, who is a transmission engineer with GRE. She's the leader of their transmission project management. She was our contact person for our project's construction of its interconnection and coordinating for interconnection to their substation. We reached out to them when we learned of this problem to ask if they'd be willing to work with us on this issue, and the upshot of that is that GRE is willing to work with us to allow the turbine to remain where it is, subject to the project providing assurances by an agreement or other form acceptable to them that in the event we cause any damage to their transmission facilities, we're responsible to repair that.
And I'll just say my personal thought on that is, so GRE is getting assurance that you will pay for the damage if this should somehow damage their power line. Mm-hmm. But we're the ones who are responsible to make sure that while that's being done, people still have power.
Understood.
And that could be a problem. And so
I think
to the
that's
extent
why
that it's just GRE's responsibility to sign off on this, I'm still not quite comfortable yet. But
so if this helps put it in context a little bit, as we were talking about in this particular case, the if this were to fall down over, it would still be 34 feet. I mean, and that doesn't happen. Turbines don't typically just tip straight over, but if it were, it'd still be 34 feet from the transmission line itself. So this is an appropriate response from a business perspective. We don't view it as a safety concern and don't believe that they would view it as a safety concern if that were the case. And if you look in the email that was sent to Crystal below, we explained to them what we, a rough approximation of what we were going to put in and, you know, indicating that it wasn't a safety concern. And they agreed with that approach. So if that helps with that context, hopefully. If you have other thoughts, we're open to it.
That's you're talking the situation where if it tipped over.
Yes.
But if the turbine, you know, it's rare, but it does occasionally happen. The turbine catches on fire, the blades become detached, and how far do they go?
I actually recently saw one, and the blade went straight down. It didn't go anywhere. So I saw a video of one that was on fire at a hearing.
Could be flung off into the distance too, I suppose.
I'm not aware of that happening, Commissioner. We had a turbine catch fire in Ontario at one of our older wind projects. In that case, the turbine shut down immediately, so nothing flew off. There were fragments of fiberglass that landed in the field below and in the area from the blade.
And
that was affected by, but in terms of throwing a blade off, no, I think that highly unlikely because the systems generally shut off.
Yeah, maybe it was an older turbine. I know I've watched a video of a turbine fire where parts were going.
Large fragments.
Every which way.
I haven't seen that.
Smith, I was just wondering, could you direct me to which one of these was the waiver from GRE?
So it's 7.
Seven.
Email. Or 5. So 7 is the waiver, and then the turbine at issue is in.
We haven't negotiated that waiver yet, but they've indicated a willingness to enter into it.
So they'd said a letter, an affidavit, something more official than an email?
The intent would be an agreement that we would provide to the commission.
Okay.
So now if we look at Exhibit 8.
Exhibit 8 shows the situation with Turbine 26. Turbine 26, which is located on the east side of Highway 41, the setback distance intrudes into the 100-foot right-of-way on the east side of the center line by 10.7 feet. So that it's slightly more than 530 feet from the edge of the right-of-way instead of 541 feet.
And if this one were to tip straight over, how far would it be from the road?
From the paved area, it would be over 100 feet. I think it's about 114 feet.
Is that how the turbine is accessed? Is that how the turbine is accessed, the maintenance road? Is that from the blacktop?
I see,
I see two lines.
Those two lines are just a farm track, Commissioner. These aerials don't show the as-built situation. These are the aerial mapping that Westwood had pre-construction, I believe.
I would guess that was from surveying because it just happens to have a trail
honest, I don't know where the access road enters for this turbine, whether it comes in directly off Highway 41 or whether it comes up from another turbine.
And then can you explain what Exhibit 9 is?
Exhibit 9 is a copy of email communications between me and Ron Henke, who is the Deputy Director for Engineering at the State North Dakota Department of Transportation. We have in that case negotiated a draft of an indemnity agreement with North Dakota DOT that would allow the turbine to remain in place. We approached DOT shortly after we met with your staff here a few weeks ago, and we have since communicated and worked through a draft of an agreement that, subject to your action allowing it to proceed, would have Capital Power indemnify the DOT for impacts of the turbine.
And so we've walked through the exhibits specifically. Can you explain what the impacts would be of moving the turbines to a new location?
Before you do that, Molly,
can
I ask?
Go ahead.
Where's the waiver for the first residence of T24?
That is, there's Exhibit 2 and Exhibit 4. Both of those are waivers. And so if it's the first turbine, it would be Exhibit 2.
Exhibit 2, yes, Commissioner.
Oh, you said that was from a different one. Okay, so Exhibit 2 is a waiver from the Exhibit 1.
Bills, yes, for okay. Exhibit 1.
All right. Thank you.
There's something that was brought up earlier, and I thought it was said that one of these landowners that signed a waiver didn't actually sign on to the agreement of their family as a participating landowner, but not them.
That's
themselves.
The outlot situation. So
that's turbine 8.
Right.
The Nelsons.
Okay, and that's the
Curtis and Diana Nelson are participating landowners. They subdivided the outlot on which their son Eric built his home out of property that originally had been part of the lease to Element Power.
So it's technically subject to the lease, but they themselves, it depends on how you view them, that lot was created after the lease. So even if they were considered non-participating, they would still meet the county's requirement of 1,300 feet for a setback.
And if they were an non-participating landowner, then are you then saying that this waiver would be considered the variance that's allowed under the law from a non-participating landowner?
Yes.
Okay. And would that still be under the 1.1 times the height of the turbine from the property line of the non-participating landowner?
Oh, we're well in excess of that.
Yeah, well, that's different.
We're well in excess of that.
Yeah,
I just want to clarify that.
Yes.
Yeah, and it technically also would not necessarily apply because it was subdivided and it's all subject to the lease. So, but yes.
Molly, would you define for me what you consider a residence? Does it include the porch, the attached garage, the detached garage, the swimming pool, if there is one? What do you think is a residence?
That's a great question, Commissioner, and I think that's part of the issue. I don't think that has ever been defined. I certainly have never considered outbuildings or things that are not attached to the home to be part of a residence. You could consider a garage that's attached to the home to be part of the residence, but you could also not, and that I think is, it's not clear, it's never been clearly defined. So I can't say because it's not my rule. So
I happened to just pull that up here 10, 15 minutes ago. Residence. A person's home, the place where someone lives, and that's about all.
Yeah.
It really says.
And I've seen it used differently in different jurisdictions, and sometimes we've talked about occupied versus occupiable, and all depends. May I ask, is there something concerning about considering one thing and not another, or is it just more going forward, how should we think about this? Is that drives your question?
Well, I look at number one, and, you know, we can kind of downplay it a little bit, as you did, by saying it's, what was it, just a few feet, 5 feet from the residence. But when I look at the garage over there, it's way closer. And
yeah, I certainly wouldn't consider the garage that's not attached by several 100 feet to be part of the residence. It's not where they live. If it's a garage that's attached to the home, then I could see
something. In hunting season, it's sometimes where we live.
But, you know, I would not consider that. I also would say that this isn't a rule. This was not a rule at the time that the commission issued this order or the order of continuing suitability. And often the commission has deferred to the county on the setback distances, which have varied. They haven't been consistently 1,400 feet.
Wasn't the 1,400-foot setback included in the continuing suitability?
It was. Okay. And that's why we're requesting the amendment to allow the waiver, since the landowners would agree to waive. And if the landowners wouldn't have agreed to waive, then that would be an issue.
But you're saying it wasn't an official rule?
It wasn't.
Yeah.
I think we were going to talk about the impacts briefly. So what are the impacts of moving the turbines?
We'd have to excavate for a new foundation. Typically, the area of impact has about a 200-foot radius. So about 400-foot diameter circle would be affected, plus additional access roads. We'd also have to remove the existing turbine at least down 4 feet below the grade. So there'd be associated environmental and landowner impacts there. We estimate at a minimum it's probably $1.25 million per turbine to move a turbine at this point, to build a new, take down the existing turbine, excavate and build a new foundation, and then erect the turbine on the new foundation once it's cured in. There's also some serious schedule impacts. I mean, we did, as we indicated, we made the decision to move turbine 32, and as Molly said, we've poured the foundation for that, but we're moving into winter now. Even that, on T32, we were lucky this week. We had some warm days where we could get the concrete pour done. I think schedule impacts would be substantial. We have a contract with our constructor, Blattner, that looks for completion of construction in mid-December, and we have an offtake agreement with Morgan Stanley that looks for offtake to begin in March of next year.
And so if there were weather issues and these couldn't be poured this spring, it could impact the ability.
If they can't be poured this fall, we're going to have a problem, I think, in getting them done. I mean, you folks know better than I how building in North Dakota is in the winter.
And we skipped this, but when we talked about landowner impacts on the second turbine, we didn't have a letter from the other landowner, but it's in a FedEx package somewhere between his home in Arizona and here that is similar to Luella Anderson's letter that had requested that it stay in place because of the impact. So when we do receive it, we will send it in.
When that arrives, see if there's any Broward County ballots in there, too.
I will do that. And, I mean, I think we've talked a little bit about this, but this isn't Capital Power's first project. This isn't an outlier. I mean, in part, my own history seeing that this project started back in, probably started in 2009, 2010, and then was permitted initially in 2011, and then was transferred from Element Power, which significantly offloaded several of their projects. I think that this is an outlier, and I know, Paul, you can speak to how you're approaching it from internally.
It's certainly been a lesson learned for our engineering and GIS groups, as well as our development team, and there's heavy scrutiny on the next several projects that we have moving towards construction over the next 2 years. That as those are advancing through our engineering group, setbacks are being scrutinized very heavily, and our GIS team is taking a much more careful look, and our engineers are going back to the source documents rather than relying on consultant reports at this point.
So I think that's kind of where we're at as far as exhibits and whatever questions the commissioners have. We're happy to answer them.
Well, on the last subject, as far as the economic considerations mm-hmm. for moving them, I'm going to point something out to you and just ask you to respond. So it's not really a question, but in the rules of the five exclusion areas that are listed, the rules only contemplate variances for one of them, and that's with the rural residences. But then I jump down one step further to avoidance areas, which have a lower threshold and which contemplate variances, but it says in there that economic considerations alone will not justify approval of a variance. So respond to that.
Certainly. So two things. One is there's actually two variances. There's the ability to get a variance from a property line setback in addition. And in this case, DOT owns the right-of-way and fee. So that's also another item we've proposed. You have both a property line setback and a road right-of-way setback. One has a variance. One does not. So they're willing to grant the variance. They own the property and fee. So there are two competing setbacks there, two competing provisions. The second is this isn't based solely on economic considerations. This is based on the impact it would pose to the landowners who have to have additional impact to their land. So one's tilled acres. So they're going to have additional impact to those tilled acres while removing this turbine, so there's additional construction time, additional impact, additional disturbance to the land on both of them. There's environmental considerations, of course. We all know every time you move dirt, there's more potential for impact. And, of course, they're following the requirements of soil segregation and all of those requirements, but they do take more to implement. I think on the flip side, too, there's not a harm caused by allowing this. It's not setting a precedent. This is a unique situation. The two facility owners, the GRE and DOT, are in agreement that this is not an issue, and they're willing to enter into an agreement to allow the turbines to remain in place. So it's not simply economics alone.
This is probably going to be call it a question of inexperience on my part. Would it be impossible just to, I'm looking at T6, for example. Is it, I realize the pedestals are uniform, they come in a certain size, but what are we talking, 34 feet, or do I have that mixed up?
Is your question, can you just move the turbine tower over on the pedestal? Is that the question you're asking?
A slightly shorter pedestal.
A detail to you on?
Just curious.
The manufacturer designs these turbines as units, Commissioner, with a specific tower height mated to the specific blade length, the specific rotor size, and they design those that way to avoid dynamic interactions that could cause failure of the tower or of the blades, and we've had some inquiries with the manufacturer, but they haven't offered up any solutions to date.
Molly, Brian, did you have more on that? I'm sorry.
No, it was more of a curiosity question, and it's never that simple, I realize, but.
Unfortunately, I wish it were.
Can you talk through again the legal path that you see?
Certainly.
To allow us to do this, because, you know, whether we agree or not, exclusion areas are exclusion areas, and this is an exclusion area. And there isn't a lot of wiggle room in the law for granting waivers on exclusion areas, except for the rural residences. So walk through the legal logic and that you've laid out here in this amended order of continuing suitability.
So the first is that this project was originally permitted. The certificate of site compatibility and the order issuing that certificate were issued in 2001. There were no turbine, 2011, it feels like 2001, but at 2011, there were no turbine-specific setback requirements that were exclusion areas at that time. So at the time that the order was issued, the only requirements were unwritten rules in air quotes. So there was nothing requiring certain setbacks. It was sort of known that the commission liked to see certain types.
Preferences.
Exactly, preferences. So those were identified as findings of fact in the order. They weren't even included actually in the order provisions of that initial order. They were just findings that the company had said they'd comply with these certain setbacks. That included the road right-of-way setback and the 1,400-foot setback and the transmission line setback.
So those were included as facts and voluntary agreements by the company in the first order.
Yes, and there was no written documentation saying, you know, we're agreeing to this. It was simply a finding. It was in the application.
They said they will blah blah blah.
Exactly. So those findings were incorporated into the order, and that's what was applied. So in 2000, the rulemaking didn't occur until after that occurred. So at the time that the order for continuing suitability, the certification for continuing suitability was sought and the order was issued, that order for continuing suitability simply says the project continues to meet the conditions upon which the order was issued. The order was issued before there were rules specific to turbine setbacks in place. And so that order relates back to the 2011 order. It's not a new issuance of the Certificate of Site Compatibility. It was still Certificate of Site Compatibility 29, and it just said it continues to meet the requirements. Here's what we're ordering, and you may construct under Certificate 29 by 2020, I believe is the date. Because there was a voluntary commitment to comply with the setback requirements in the 2013 rulemaking, there's an order provision, and it's 4B. And had that not specified that there was compliance with those rules, they would not have applied. There was a commitment to comply with them. That commitment can be altered because it is not saying that we're altering the exclusion areas, it's altering the commitment to apply those exclusion areas voluntarily. That's why this is so unique, and there's not another project that would be in this position. And so that's why we've proposed in B, Meadowlark shall comply with those requirements except as specified for these two turbines, the specific measurement specifying the distance that it is now from the state highway right-of-way, and that the setback for the turbine nearest to the Great River Energy Transmission Line would be measured from the center line of the right-of-way, and then we would provide copies of the agreements that would all be subject to agreement from both GRE and DOT, and we would provide copies of those agreements. And so that's why this isn't a situation where we're asking to vary the exclusion areas. We're asking to vary a commitment made in an order by a company that had a certificate prior to the rules being enacted. And so it's a different situation. It's not a change of the rule. It's a change of the commitment.
So do you think that the reason, so what's the reason for these continuings? Continuing suitability certificates. Why is there the 4 years? Why are we supposed to review this stuff? Is it just simply to make sure that the site is still suitable, or should there be a bringing up of the to current standards of the companies under, you know, the laws as they're adopted over those years?
I don't myself think that it's exactly clear. It does say it's specific in the statute to say that it's a certification that it continues to meet the conditions upon which the certificate was granted. So that relates back in time to when the certificate was granted. It could, one thing that could happen is things could change within the site. So if, as particularly as you get further and further past 4 years, you could see development coming into an area. You could see a different use that it's being put to. And maybe it no longer has the ability to comply with the order that was originally issued. And so in those situations, it wouldn't be appropriate to say it can go ahead and start construction because now there's some other, maybe they, you know, built a different facility there. So given the way the statute is written, because the statute has very specific wording, that's why I see it going back to the certificate issuance time period.
Just briefly, I'd like to, I guess, just point out one thing. That just because the certificate of continuing suitability does go back to the original time, it doesn't mean that the company isn't required to possibly modify the site if it's the commission finds this in the public interest. Actually, the certification number 6 that they signed off on, and pretty much on all our orders, expresses that. I guess one thing I just wanted to revisit real quick is there was a lot of discussion about this fall down height, and this is probably directed more towards the staff because I think they were involved in the rulemaking. We kept talking about how this would crumple and generally fall straight down from our experiences, but it's plausible that it could fall straight over sideways. I mean, because that's due to the structural integrity that it crumples and falls straight down, correct? Okay. And, Jerry, I think you were actually the one who testified in the rulemaking. And in your testimony, you spoke about the fall-down height, which was inconveniently only recorded and not actually put in there with text, but when I listened through that, you talked about the fall down height, and I was wondering if you could explain what that is and the rationale at the time for the rulemaking, since you were involved in that.
I don't really remember what I said on the stand 10 years ago. But
shocking, Jerry.
But I remember the 1.1 times the turbine height was just used because it was a common, you couldn't really call it a standard, but I'll use that word in the industry. It was commonly referred to as a fall down distance. And you need something. That's what they used.
Jerry, I looked back at the fall down height, but I also accidentally pulled up a bunch of other testimony from previous cases prior to that actual rulemaking. And the fall down height, in that 1.1 times the tide of the turbine, the concerns weren't only the fall down height, were they? Because I saw a number of testimonies that were provided that discussed other concerns as well.
since we've been siting these wind turbines, there has been an ongoing discussion that has varied from case to case on how far away things need to be from things, and that's why we wrote these rules.
Right.
But the 1,400 feet was first proposed in our first wind project, and we kind of used that a little bit for a while, and we never adopted it just because we went with the wind or with the sound measurement instead.
Jerry, not to mean to interrupt, but have we had turbines sited with less than 1,400 feet?
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
I think they've been in the 1,300 feet ranges that we're talking about here. Usually it's a participating landowner that wants the turbine and doesn't mind it being that close to their residence.
And just to jog your memory as well, and this is something not quite as related to the setbacks, but the Certificate of Continuing Suitability, you're involved in the Foxtail case as well, correct?
Yeah.
Did we do a Certificate of Continuing Suitability in that case as well?
No.
We didn't? Okay.
We did it in the Elite Clean Energy case.
It was Elite Clean Energy?
Yes.
Thank you.
Jack, are you concerned about precedents? I mean, when you go through these specifics from a practical standpoint, I don't have a lot of concerns. But my concern comes in with straying from, you know, or suggesting in any way that these are somehow changeable setbacks. And then we've just got a mess on our hands.
Absolutely, Commissioner. And with regards to the first filing that they had when they discussed the variance from the exclusion area, I would have some concerns with that. I don't think we should get in the practice of issuing variances to our exclusion areas, and I'm not sure. I would believe, actually, that the law would not provide for that under how we've been interpreting and the precedent that we've used. However, if the Commission is looking to... I guess the second filing that they had where they talked about essentially the retroactivity of the rulemaking. If you do change the order on continuing certification, I do think that would be a very specific case. I can't imagine this could even possibly come up more than four or five times with any outstanding certificates. And so that would be a unique case. And I also think that the theory presented is a plausible legal theory for application.
To what extent do we tie in and be consistent in our judgments with various things that we regulate? We just finished a coal mine penalty where one of the mines got with a few feet closer, less than 100 feet from a cemetery, and disrupted the grass and fixed it, and we issued a penalty anyway. And so I find it hard to be so inconsistent to say that in mining, you know, you cross a line and there's going to be a penalty. But over here in these sitings, you cross a line and come in and point out that it costs $2 million to move it, and then we would shrug our shoulders and give a variance. Does it seem like there at least ought to be some sort of a penalty involved?
Do you mind if I intervene for a second?
It's an open question, yes.
I mean, we've thought about all the different things going on with this project. A lot of them we're not happy with, too. And we would be open to discussing, you know, some sort of penalty as part of the, you know, how we move forward on this. We understand that there are precedents that you're potentially concerned about. And we don't take these, you know, these issues lightly. And as Paul said earlier, this isn't the norm for how we operate, and this is why we're here today, because we brought these issues forward. So, you know, I think your question is a valid one, and, you know, I just want to be transparent with you that we're not adverse to that, if other sectors have had to deal with that as well.
Yeah, and then this is another open-ended one, whichever attorney or other brilliant mind around the table wants to answer. I wasn't here when the rules were adopted as far as the roads, but I believe there's a combination of reasons for that, and I don't consider them to be arbitrary because, while I haven't went back and reviewed all the evidence that was presented, there was some thought given because state highways and interstates are from the right-of-way and county roads are the center line plus some number of feet. They did it differently, which certainly indicates some thought was given to it. And I can see a number of reasons. The fall down, which is probably rare. Throwing ice, which is probably rare, but I've heard of it more than I've heard of them just tipping straight over. But I think probably the most important reason is you drive around the city, these roads change. And then someday something comes up and you need to alter the road a little bit, and now you're right underneath the thing. And so I think there's a lot of good reasons for keeping a setback. And whether it's a foot or 50 feet, on that one, maybe more than the others in my mind, it seems to me that granting a variance sort of suggests that that distance isn't so meaningful, that it's just an arbitrary number, and if the DOT gets paid some money and says it's okay, then I guess it's okay. And I just find that to be kind of a precedent for someone else to suggest that these numbers are in fact arbitrary.
Mr. Chairman, just to clarify that, I guess one issue with regards to that, one of the possibilities was a variance, but I believe the second possibility that was presented by the company was not a variance, but a changing of the responsibilities and what they required to do so that they only had to go back to the original requirements under the original site certificate. So that would require the amendment of the order of continuing suitability, so that they would no longer be subject to those changed rules.
Let me be clarified. It's not even that far. All it's saying is this commitment to comply with the rules as they were amended in 2013, modifying that commitment slightly for these two turbines. And it would not be done if the Department of Transportation did not agree. And we view them as having significant expertise in dealing with transportation. They understand the situation, and they don't have a concern, or they wouldn't have agreed, you know, wouldn't have been working on agreement and wouldn't have come to a verbal agreement on this. So that's where it's different. And we aren't asking for a variance. I do want to make that very clear. It's a modification, very specific. The reason why, even beyond what we've talked about, it wouldn't come up is these rules were enacted in 2013. This order was issued in 2012. It would have to be a project before these rules were enacted in 2013. There's not that many projects that obtained certificates before that weren't constructed or haven't had them withdrawn. I know of one that was completely withdrawn. So this is a very, very rare, limited situation. It's not a variance. It's just a slight modification of the commitment. And so we will, if we need to, officially withdraw the variance request if that is to avoid any confusion, if you would like us to do so.
Can you tell me?
I'm sorry, Commissioner.
Can you tell me when Tetra Tech actually did the measurements?
Those were done in November of 2016.
November of 2016.
Well, 2016 is
preparation
when we filed the
application. October, November of 2016 when they prepared the application for the Certificate of Continuing Suitability. What I was going to note also on that, Chairman Christman, is that and I can't speak to the specific language, but I believe in the agreement that DOT and we have negotiated, there's language regarding if they need to relocate facilities and need our turbine to be in some way modified as a result of that need, We're agreeing to address that at the time that they have to modify their facilities. I view that as pretty unlikely on Highway 41, but there's language to that effect in the proposed agreement.
So I'm going to go back. Can you tell me when the pedestals were poured?
The turbine foundation is made of about 450 cubic yards of concrete and about 80 tons of steel and steel rebar and the anchor bolts. It's about 60 feet across, and at the outer edge, its base is about eight to 9 feet below grade. At the outer edge is maybe a foot of concrete, and then it tapers up to the middle where there's a concrete cylinder that the anchor bolts run up through, and the concrete cylinder is roughly a foot bigger in diameter than the tower that sits on it.
Right.
And those anchor bolts come up, and then the tower flange bolts down onto those anchor bolts, which go all the way to the bottom of the foundation, are embedded in the concrete and grouted in place.
When was it poured, though, the concrete?
Original foundations were poured, I think almost all of these foundations were poured in August or early September, Commissioner?
Of this year,
yes.
Okay.
The ALTA survey was conducted, and we first got results in late September, early October. I forget when we first came across this. But
verifying the measurements that were originally,
yes,
staking things out,
yes,
et cetera.
The survey was conducted after the foundations were all done, and several tower base and midsections were already installed on some of the foundations.
But you'd measure twice, so to speak, and before actually pouring.
The construction contractor does a survey to be sure that they're in the right place, and they were in the right place in terms of the location specified in our documents. What we hadn't checked was that location met all the setback requirements.
Was that Tetra Tech that also did the second set of measurements?
No, sir. No, the construction contractor, Blattner, hired a surveyor to survey in the turbine locations. That's typically how the construction proceeds.
They also chose the center line?
They weren't measuring from the setback. They weren't measuring setbacks. They were measuring locations of turbines based on monumentation of the however surveyors do their work to we specified a location in terms of either northing and easting or latitude longitude in degrees, minutes, seconds, and tenths of seconds.
So Tetra Tech put in the monuments?
No, the monuments are pre-existing, probably USGS. I mean,
Okay.
Tetra Tech provided the locations that they said met the setbacks, and then those were the locations that were
surveyed. And that's the mistake that has cascaded through this process.
Okay, so the center line was irrelevant to the second.
Yeah, the contractor was not measuring off the center line. They were simply measuring to assure that their location matched the location that we specified in our contract documents.
What's the diameter of the turbine hub at the ground level?
You mean the turbine tower, sir?
Yeah.
The base of the tower is probably about 14 and a half to 15 feet in diameter.
And when you measure your tipping point, I mean, you're very precise in here, down to the tenth of a foot. When you're measuring the 541 feet, are you measuring from the middle or from the edge where
rules measure from the center?
We specified the center because it doesn't specify in the rules, so we've typically put in orders that it's measured from the center of the base of the turbine.
Okay. Can you tell me again? Sorry to keep going down this road, but so the contractor came in, went off of the monuments, makes sense. Said, yep, everything's where it should be, or so to speak, or put them
where our contract specified it to be.
Yeah, okay. So they're doing their work. And then at what point was it discovered that, wait a second?
We discovered it when Westwood provided us when we Westwood was doing the ALTA survey, which is needed for our title insurance and financing documents. And as part of that ALTA survey, they survey everything against the required setbacks. So they look at the county setbacks, and they look at the state setbacks. And when they applied those to the dimensions that they'd measured in the field, they came back to us and reported in late September that it looks like you have a problem with these turbines. And at that point, we started to try to figure out how do we deal with that problem.
They're typically, ALTA surveys are typically a confirmation, they're not designed to identify problems. They're designed to show confirmation for financing purposes. So,
would the company be agreeable on the amended order to a change to order provision for sub C to also provide some language regarding a variance if there is a non-participating landowner as well?
So in this case, though they're technically that land is participating. So I guess I'm just unclear whether you're thinking it would apply in this circumstance. The intent really isn't, it could be more limited if it needs to be. It could be unless Meadowlark obtains a waiver, signed waiver from the landowners with respect to turbines X and Y. We could be very specific.
I'm thinking more specifically to write that broader in case if it is found to be a non-participating landowner opposed to a participating landowner, which would have a variance. The other one has different requirements for non-participating. So instead of the waiver for the 500 feet or 1,400 feet, requirements would be the three times the height of the turbine or setback from their non-participating landowner's property line by 1.1 times the turbine height.
And so how would the variance differ in practical terms?
In practical terms, it wouldn't.
Okay.
But
you're trying to tie it back to the language?
Yes.
Got it. Yes.
So
I think I understand.
So the 1.1 times the turbine height requirement from a property owner landowner's boundary, that came in with these new rules.
Right.
Okay, so it
and statute too.
With the original certificate, and the statute, if I remember right, wasn't in place until after the certificate was issued either.
That's correct. So I'm saying if we're going to change this, and if we were just going to try to avoid all possible discussion of this, that we could easily remedy that by putting that in there if the company would be agreeable to that.
Okay, I guess I'm back to the word variance.
Sure.
We're not doing variances here.
We have it as a variance in the statute and in the rules. That's how it's listed, not a waiver, Jerry.
No, because the statute and rules don't apply.
Sure.
Other than the commitment that they made to follow them.
Right.
So if you take the commitment away.
Right, I recognize that. I just thought for consistency it would be easier if we did that.
Any other questions?
No.
Just a couple more questions. So okay. just to create a quick summary of a couple items that were pointed out here, the company isn't contesting whether or not they were aware of the certification relating to order provisions or the provision of the order, Tetra Tech, the company. I just mean, looking from the pre-construction hearing, the company was well aware of all those requirements then.
We were meeting them.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, so the company then isn't disputing the fact that they're in violation then as well?
No.
Okay.
Not as the order is as it is written, no.
Sure. Thank you.
Is that it? Okay. Are there any objections to the evidence produced today, both the written documents as well as the recording being part of the official record?
No.
So the evidence that has been presented today, both the written and the recording, will be made a part of the record upon which a decision will be made. Are there any other matters for the record?
If we may, once we receive the letter that we understand is in the mail, we would mark it as Exhibit 10 and provide that as well. Could it also be part of the record?
I'm not seeing why not, Jack. Do you have
an objection?
Okay.
All right. No, and we can provide electronic copies as well.
That's the letter from DOT?
No, it's the letter from the landowner that currently has the turbine that is the DOT, DOT, but it's, I forget is the name. Thank you, Mr. Berg.
But are the signed orders from DOT and GRE that aren't here, are they going to be made part of the record?
The agreements? At my understanding is that they were waiting pending the outcome of the commission's decision before executing agreements, but we would file copies with the commission as a condition of the order, and that's what we've indicated in our proposed amendments.
I recall now. Okay, any other matters for the record?
Mr. Chairman, I just one matter from the position, from staff's position, of how if there's anything that you would like us to do moving forward or to proceed with this as well. Is there any commission direction?
I don't know that I have a specific direction right now. There's a lot of new information here to mull over. And I'm going to continue reading over these rules. To me, what you're suggesting that, well, it was this an agreement, and so we could allow you out of that, and that's different than doing a straight-up variance. To me, that's kind of a fine line, and I just want to think about that. I also want to think about, like I said, what kind of a precedent we're setting, regardless of what the avenue is of how we get to the point of leaving a turbine closer than what we've typically allowed to, especially a state highway, whether that kind of minimizes the importance of that rule at all, and then the next case people are in saying, well, this is really a good wind location, you can make an exception again, and we'll put another one close. And so I just have some things to think about, and so I don't have a specific direction right now. But
all right, so for now, the commission is fine with staff not exploring any particular process, alternative processes or anything else, and just waiting for further direction.
Are you two going to want a work session?
I think we'll probably need one.
Okay, then we'll set one up at our next meeting, proposed dates.
From my own perspective, I didn't hear anyone else mention it, but as we mull over this information for a short period of time to come up with something, it wouldn't bother me a bit if you continued discussions with Mr. Son regarding a possible penalty. Agreement. Anything else?
Thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you. This informal hearing is closed.
Thank you.
Me too.